You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. My guest this week is the legendary performance artist, writer and critic Andrea Fraser. Since the early 1980s, her pioneering work examining the structures, ideologies and economics of the art world has been dubbed institutional critique, a genteel phrase in the case of Fraser's work, which does little justice to the fearless, penetrating and sometimes disturbing work she produces. From her early work as a subversive museum guide whose tour contains a critique of the institutions he navigates, to her recent multi-voice monologues created from the composite speech of numerous individuals, Fraser combines the analytic complexity of Pierre Bourdieu's sociological analysis with a highly effective presence as a performer that both arrests and actually activates the perennial passive spectator. Last month saw the publishing of her new book, 2016, in Museums, Money and Politics. It's a huge investigation into the financial contributions made to political parties by the trustees of over 125 American museums during the election year that saw Republicans and a dangerously narcissistic reality TV personality come to power. I spoke to Andrea earlier this week and began by asking if there was a specific moment that led to the development of the book.
Yeah, it was the revelation that Steven Mnuchin, who was the chair of the finance chair of Donald Trump's presidential campaign, served as a trustee on the board of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. And actually, I became aware of that shortly after he joined Trump's team back in spring 2016. And I remember being at a MoCA gala, you know, because sometimes I get invited to these things, and some friends and colleagues pointing him out and saying, you know, how horrified they were to be in the same event with this, you know, this guy who was helping Trump get elected. And they were members of the community in Los Angeles, the arts community, who through various efforts, both inside and outside of the museum, tried to, tried to influence the museum and the board to get him to step down, to no avail. And shortly after the election, I was involved in co-writing an open letter to MoCA about Mnuchin. And actually, the morning that we were going to release the letter with lots and lots of signatures to the press, we got a call from MoCA indicating that he had stepped down and his name was off the website. You know, it's unclear whether our letter did it or whether it was just that he was preparing to take up the post of Treasury Secretary in the Trump administration and was stepping down from all his boards. But in the context of developing that open letter about Mnuchin's membership on the Board of Trustees of the Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art, you know, I realized, well, I should look at what the other trustees of MoCA are doing. And I found that, in fact, there were a number of other Trump supporters on that board. And then I started looking at other boards. And that's how the idea for the book developed.
Let's talk about the structure of the book. It is quite a tome. I actually don't have a physical copy, but
I don't have a physical copy. Sorry, you should.
But but you have in front of you at the moment. So could you just describe how the book is structured? I have a PDF of it, so I can see why people are describing it a bit like a telephone book.
Right. Well, telephone book was the concept from the very beginning, and I worked with the designer, and we said telephone book, telephone book, telephone book, and it really does feel a lot like a telephone book. Except for telephone books are usually published, at least the ones that I'm familiar with, on newsprint. And this book has, you know, slightly better paper. But it's about, I would say, 2 inches thick. It's standard letter size, which is sort of roughly, I think, what, A4 in the UK. And it's organized. It has 3 main sections. It has an extensive introduction that I wrote, and then it has a section on each museum that's included, so 128 museums that lists some basic information about each museum, like its total operating budget, the members of U.S. Congress that represent the state and the district in which the museum is located. And then it has a list of all of the board members of the museum with dots indicating the board members for which we found political contributions. And the dots are color-coded to indicate the partisan or ideological lean of the contributions we found. And then there's a pie graph for every museum that shows the breakdown of the political orientation of the board members. Now I wish that I had included a second pie graph that shows the breakdown of the money, because right. in most cases it shifts significantly to the right from the board members to the money. But that only gets you up to about page 130. So the bulk of the book, which is about 940 pages long, are the contribution records of individual board members listed alphabetically by last name. So that's when you get into the telephone book section of the book. And the designer came up with this brilliant idea of, you know, with each section by letter, the letters bleed to the edge. And so on the side of the book, you can see these little blocks of gray kind of stepping down from the front to the back, which show the letters, and with a lot of M's and a lot of S's. So we had about a total of 36, we found 36,000 contribution records. And we probably, you know, if we had been a little bit less rigorous with our review, we might have included up to 40,000, I would say, because we wanted to make sure that we didn't misrepresent anyone. So we erred on the side of caution.
What was the compilation period? How long did it take you to get all this information together?
It was about 7 months full time. And I had three assistants who were very part-time, who really only put in about 300 hours total. And then I worked with a designer who had a team that included a programmer who did the basic data scrape, that is, who ran all the names on the website of the Federal Election Commission and downloaded the basic contribution data. But that process turned up a million results.
Wow, that's a lot.
Right, because there are a lot of people, you know, it's a big country, so there are a lot of people with the same name or with similar names. So the million results were then filtered, and that was cut in half. But we went through about half a million, 500,000 contribution records one by one, basically, because we had to, you know, we had to look up every individual whose name returned records to confirm that those contributions were by the individual who's the trustee of the institution and not by someone else of the same name. And then when we went through that process, then I manually searched about 2,000 names. So we started out with about 5,460 individual trustees. And in the end, we have records in the book for 44% of that population, which is an incredibly high percentage. It's a very, very active population politically. So that's compared to 0.68% of the U.S. adult population nationally that makes contributions that are recorded by the FEC. So 44% versus 0.68%. So that gives you a sense of the kind of influence that's concentrated in, you know, this group, in addition to the amount of money that we found, which is close to, you know, I think over $250 million.
Let's go into percentages a bit more now. So when I first heard about 2016, I thought it was about pointing to like the large amount of right-wing donors on museum boards. But actually, of the roughly 212 million in contributions that you tracked, 57% went to Democrats, while 42% went to Republicans. So the real story here, it seems to be about plutocracy, or rather the control that the wealthy have over political and cultural institutions. Why should we be worried about this?
Well, first of all, I don't want to totally minimize that, you know, the fact that 42% is still a huge amount, a huge percentage of people who, as trustees, have committed to a fiduciary responsibility to institutions on which they serve, you know, boards as trustees, to protect the interests of those institutions and to further the mission of those institutions. And I think that, you know, there's a very clear argument to be made that supporting right-wing politicians, white supremacist politicians, politicians who are attacking the media, who are attacking journalists, who are attacking free speech, who have attacked also artists directly, who are undermining democracy in many, many ways, are a direct threat to these institutions and to their missions. So there's a conflict there. There's a conflict of interest, and there's a failure of fiduciary responsibility that we can see on the part of these trustees who are supporting. Right now, it's not only radical. I mean, it's not just Trump. It's the entire Republican Party, which has now become the party of Trump. So I don't want to minimize that. I think it's still a very, very high percentage. It's not the majority. But in many museums that one would consider to be very progressive institutions that are located in, you know, solidly blue cities and solidly blue states, that is Democrat voting areas, you might still have, you know, a majority of individual trustees who are supporting Democratic candidates and liberal organizations, but the majority of the money that's coming out of those boards is going to Republicans. So that should still be a shock. So, I mean, we can get into the plutocracy argument too, but I don't want to minimize the degree of hypocrisy. I mean, the other thing is that these are people who are supporting politicians who are running, you know, as so-called populists, as right-wing populists, by railing against so-called educated elites and cultural elites, you know, when they're on the board of organizations that are, in some sense, the institution of exactly those kinds of elites.
Which speaks to the question of what motivates wealthy people to do this. The idea that wealthy people are kind of running things culturally and politically isn't necessarily a new revelation.
No, that's not surprising anybody.
But it also begs the question, what now? Because a good part of contemporary art is yoked to high finance, and in such a way that exclusivity and critique sort of go hand in hand, whether it's through the trappings of like high fashion worn by the people who attend openings, or it's the sort of the air of sort of rarefied esoteric academic distance, which also seems to only be able to take place in like quite nicely designed halls by certain architects. Somehow we've gone from, okay, this is a bit of a simplification, but the kind of rough cabaret Voltaire, random club, people getting pissed in the beginning of the 20th century, to this this thing in the 21st century where it's all exclusive, everybody's wearing Major Margiela. How do we extricate high finance from the world of contemporary art?
Well, there are a whole bunch of different questions and issues, I think, that you've just raised. And In 2011, I wrote an essay called Le 1% C'est Moi, which can be found online pretty easily. And I tracked down a paper by three economists called Art and Money, where they looked at auction prices and at movements in the art market over the past few decades. And then they looked at the correspondence between the increase in art market prices and the concentration of wealth in mostly in the United States and Britain. And what they found was pretty alarming. they found that with every, I think it was 1% increase in the income share of the 0.1% of the population, they found a 14% increase in auction prices. So they found a very strong direct correlation between wealth concentration and art prices, at least in the secondary market. And they did not find a similar correlation to other economic indicators like, you know, gross national product, increase in gross national product. So, you know, what that tells us is that art, you know, has become a luxury market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at there's the World Wealth Report. I can't remember who publishes it, and about ultra high net worth individuals, where art is grouped with yachts and wine and jewelry and cars and other luxury goods and luxury collectibles. And so, you know, that's been developing for some time, although it really, really took hold, I think, in the 90s, and has become increasingly institutionalized as a kind of financial sector. Since then, but I do think what's happened also since the 90s, since the 80s, since the 70s, is we've had an enormous global expansion of the art field. Right. And with that global expansion, we have what I've seen and talked about or understood as, on the one hand, this kind of explosion of the market, but also the explosion of the field of museums, the explosion of the field of international exhibitions, biennials, and so forth, the explosion of art programs, you know, in art schools and universities, of development of PhD programs. So the art field has exploded in a lot of different sort of areas that I see as resulting in the development of the kind of fragmentation of the art world. I mean, so we've had the financialization of the part of the art world that's the market, it's the galleries, it's the auction houses, it's the art fairs.
Right.
But we've also had the development of these other parts of the art field, you know, of museums, of international exhibitions, of PhD programs and artistic research in the academic field, and also of cultural activism and social practice and community-based art in a lot of different contexts globally. So the way that I understand that is that what we're seeing with this huge expansion of the art field and of the art market, but also is the kind of fragmentation of the art field into these different subfields that are becoming increasingly autonomous. And I think they can develop with different values and with different discourse and with different, you know, with different practices and different economies. So, you know, no, the mainstream of the art world is not the Cabaret Voltaire, but that doesn't mean that Cabaret Voltaires don't exist, you know, in the world and can't still have a kind of disruptive influence and a political influence. It's a matter of contesting these social spaces.
Okay, so now to labor this comparison to the Cabaret Voltaire a bit more, it seems to me that this book, 2016, would be best served in the hands of those people sitting at the tables in the Cabaret Voltaires that exist in the UK or in America or wherever at the moment. But at a cost of £97, that's how much it costs in Waterstones. You know, the book is kind of priced out of the reach of most people. So what's the thinking behind the pricing?
I actually think that the book needs to be in the hands of, I mean, this might seem ironic and it might seem cynical, but I don't think it's ironic or cynical. I think the book needs to be in the hands of the people who do fundraising for museums. It needs to be in the hands of development professionals in American art museums, and it needs to be in the hands of museum directors, and it needs to be in the hands of, you know, the chairs and the members of boards.
Do those people have the will and the appetite to trouble a system that sits at the bottom of their very being, like their very sort of financial security? It strikes me that a museum director would be the sort of person to pore over this, maybe do a talk about it, but not do anything about it.
Well, I've had a couple of interesting experiences where I've sat down with, okay, I'm the chair of the art department now at UCLA, at the University of California, Los Angeles. And as the chair of the art department, you know, it's a public university, but it's increasingly dependent on private funding now because of cutbacks from the state. So as chair, I have regular meetings with the fundraiser for the School of the Arts and Architecture. And one of the last meetings that I had with her, I brought my book to show her. She says, oh, I know all these people, right? And so, and we started talking about various opportunities that she was pursuing, you know, for the school and for the department. And because of the presence of the book, the politics of the people that she was dealing with became part of the conversation.
Right.
And I had another experience of presenting the book at a meeting of the Artist Council of the Hammer Museum, of which I'm a member. And at that meeting, the president of the board of overseers also happened to attend that meeting. And there was a discussion about trustees and trusteeship. And I was able to make a presentation about the book in that context. And it becomes part of the conversation. It becomes part of the conversation. And I think that is the, you know, that is a place to start. And so I think that change has to come from without as well as from within. I think the most effective strategies, at least in my experience, and this is how I understand my experience with, for example, the open letter to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles,
right,
that there was a combination. There were people in the institution who wanted Mnuchin off the board, you know, but they're in the institution. They have jobs. They have jobs that are not secure, you know. They can be fired at any time. There's no job security in museums in America. Directors and curators can be fired at any time, pretty much by the board or by the director, and that just recently happened to the chief curator at MoCA, as a matter of fact. But they need cover from the outside, so they need pressure from the community. So they can take that letter to the board and to the director and say, you know, look, the community is putting pressure on us. This is bad for the institution. We need to do something, right? So I think that's how, you know, that's one way that it works. I think just demonstrations outside of the museum are not going to be as effective as a kind of double-pronged initiative.
I suppose I wasn't thinking of necessarily demonstrations, but I suppose of informing a new cohort of actors who are animating the art world that maybe some of the institutions that they're desperately trying to get into might not be as valuable or conducive to the progression of the field that they're trying to contribute to. And that maybe they might be better served elsewhere, or might be better served trying to create a different system that's not necessarily dependent on wealthy donations, even if they are from Democrats as opposed to Republicans.
Well, right, right. So I think the other component of this for me, you know, ultimately this is, I see this, although it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't the focus of my introduction, but this is an argument for public funding.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we can trace the changes in trusteeship and the, you know, the bloom of the sort of influence of museum boards and trustees, and the changes in the composition of museum boards, to the kind of bulking up on billionaires. We can trace all that back to the decline in public funding for arts and for museums that, you know, that started in the early 90s. So alternative modes of funding, sources of funding, are really the only way out of the problem of the influence of trustees and the kind of pay-to-play culture of nonprofit governance in the United States. But the other aspect of this that I think is kind of, say, a halfway point for me in terms of in terms of the kinds of, you know, consequences or the kinds of programmatic changes that might come out of the research for this book, is the diversification of boards, not only in terms of race and ethnicity, because these boards are overwhelmingly white in the United States, but also in terms of the kinds of the sort of range of stakeholders represented on boards, the range of constituents of institutions represented on boards. So one of the things that, you know, it's actually, it was sort of side research. It's not the main research of the book, of course, was in about political contributions. But in the context of writing the introduction, I came across research that showed a sort of dramatic increase in the number of boards, not only museum boards, but all nonprofit boards in the United States, that now that require personal financial contributions of their board members. So this was the thing that sort of put the nail on the, you know, I don't want to say the nail on the coffin, but you know, it's a sort of smoking gun for me that identifies this sort of system of nonprofit organizations in the United States as plutocratic, because this is pay to play. You know, in a political sphere, we would call that pay to play.
Right.
Right. Because these boards ultimately are governing board. It's about governance. These boards play the sort of basic role in governing, in governance of a major sector of American society, of what is sometimes identified with civil society itself, the nonprofit sector. And if that, if governance, if a role in governance in that sector can be bought, you know, I mean, that is a corrupt plutocratic system. And that's got to change.
So now I'd like to just talk a bit about your practice. So I want to go right the way back. So you moved to New York in 1981, and I calculated that. And that was that you were 16.
I was 16. Yeah, I was basically 2 months. It was 2 months after my 16th birthday. I dropped out of high school after 2 years and 2 weeks. And then I moved to New York a couple of months later.
Okay,
and now, started art school. Mm-hmm.
That's an incredibly courageous and determined thing to do. What were you looking for in the city at the age of 16? What did you want to find?
Well, let me. There's a little bit more context to it. So, first of all, I had a brother and a sister who were in New York and had found a 3-bedroom apartment. So I was able to move in with them. I wasn't completely on my own. And nobody in my family did 4 years of high school, so it wasn't so unusual. But, you know, I dropped out of high school, and I thought about being an artist, but I think after dropping out of high school, I kind of recognized that art school was probably the only place I was going to be able to go from there, you know. and that kind of solidified my career trajectory. But my mother was born in Puerto Rico, and then she studied in the United States. And in the 50s, she studied the Art Students League in New York with some of the abstract expressionists of the era. And she painted and also did some performance and Super 8 films and other kinds of stuff until my early childhood. So I had some sense that New York was a place to go if I wanted to be an artist, and I had some sense of what that might, you know, what it might take, I guess.
But then what were you thinking an artist did at the age of 16? Were you still thinking abstract expressionism?
Oh, no. No, well, after, I mean, my mother studied, you know, she studied with abstract expressionists, then she painted until about the late, you know, the late 60s, and then she did performances and happenings and films. And so I grew up with some awareness of avant-garde, you know, culture, of post-war avant-garde culture. And also my mother got involved in the feminist movement in the late 60s, and I actually went to the pre-opening of Judy Chicago's dinner party at SF MoMA when I was 13.
Wow.
I cut class to take the bus to San Francisco with a school friend whose mother worked on the project. So I was also very aware of, you know, of feminist art and of, you know, and of political art. So I had, you know, I did have I grew up in Berkeley, so that should tell you.
I tried to track the age that you joined the Whitney. Am I right that you were 19?
I was 18, actually.
You were 18.
So then I dropped out of, so when I got to New York, I applied to the School of Visual Arts, and I got into the School of Visual Arts. The School of Visual Arts, I'd like to remind people, is actually a for-profit art school, so they accept just about everybody. But there were some incredible people teaching there, so I got to take performance art with Simone Forti, and I got to take video art with Dara Birnbaum, and I got to study with Craig Owens and with Benjamin Buklo, who were tremendously influential, and particularly Craig Owens, who sort of shepherded me to the Whitney Independent Study Program when I decided to drop out of art school. So I'm a serial dropout. So then I went to the Whitney Independent Study Program when I was 18 for a year and a half. And that was pretty much the end of my my educational career when I was 20. I was sort of done.
But you know, the word prodigy is not often used in relation to art. Well, not anymore anyway. Because it's always tied to the ideas of like technical proficiency, you know, like the young violinist or like the amazing realist painter who's only age 6. But it seemed to me that you must have had a kind of an awareness of yourself and your critical voice that was kind of far in advance of your years. And maybe it's just me, because at the age of 18, like, I don't know. I didn't even know who I was. I didn't know what was going on in the world, really. I just wanted to possibly get high every now and then, have a few beers. That was it, and play the guitar.
My pothead phase ended when I was 14, actually. Yeah. So I moved on. Well, I think it was a consequence of growing up, growing up in a large family. You know, I was the youngest of 5, and my parents got involved. My father was a Unitarian minister. And my mother got involved in the feminist movement and came out as a lesbian in the early 70s. So it was a time and a place where I think people grew up fast. I think there was a lot of exposure. There were a lot of, you know, there were a lot of cultural changes, a lot of changes in my family, a lot of political changes. And I was exposed to a lot, perhaps in some ways, you know, too much. I mean, I've been a little traumatized by some of the things I was exposed to.
How did your lecturers react to you? Because when I was reading back through some of the texts that are collected in Museum Highlights, you know, the MIT book, compendium of some of your critical texts or the sort of scripts that you've used for performances, going back to the essay In and Out of Place that you wrote on the artist Louise Lawler, I think when you were 20, is that right?
I was 19.
You were 19. Okay, now, if I was to include an essay I'd written at the age of 19 in a book, that'd be pretty embarrassing. But that stood up. I mean, it stood up against...
Well, I was extraordinarily lucky. I was really in the right place at the right time.
Right.
And I was extraordinarily lucky to connect with Craig Owens, who was an editor of Art in America. And I was sitting in on his class about art criticism, and I suggested that I write, I proposed to write something about Louise Lawler for his class. And Craig was a feminist, and I was a young feminist, and he wanted to support people like me. He said, well, if you take it seriously, maybe we can publish it. And he worked with me through multiple drafts of that essay, and I actually still have every draft with his editorial comments on it. I saved them all, and he taught me how to write in the process. And I mean, it wasn't terrible. You can look at the first draft; wasn't terrible. I can't spell to save my life. My grammar is terrible.
But who needs grammar? That's what copy editors are for, you know.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, I think I was certainly very aware of being very young, and it was one of the things that I brought to performing when I started doing performances in the form of museum tours, which was in 1986. When I was the first one I did, I was 21, and when I talk about institutional critique and how I started down that road, I do talk about that that period of my life and what my experience was of moving from Berkeley, where I was a kind of came out of a kind of countercultural family, you know, with handmade clothes and so on and so forth, and moving to New York, to the sort of center of the kind of cultural capital of America, and some people, you know, New Yorkers would say the world, with institutions like the Museum of Modern Art and the Metropolitan Museum and the Whitney Independent Study Program, which are these sort of banks of these banks of cultural capital, you know, these institutions with tremendous legitimacy and authority that I aspired to being a part of, and aspired to that legitimacy, and I felt absolutely crushed by them, and I felt absolutely illegitimate. But I had the tools to reflect on that experience of illegitimacy. And I had the tools, I mean, I think, you know, ultimately I had the tools also to recognize my own conflicted relationship to that legitimacy.
But this is what is extraordinary about you as a performer. I'm glad we can get onto this subject now, because for me, you project absolute legitimacy. And let's say legitimacy as a performer, legitimacy as a performer that transcends how performance is judged in the art world, for example. So performance sometimes is judged in the art world. People have a lot more patience. There's a lot more time with you know, people not very, you know, no one's got much presence. That's all okay. But if you step out onto a stage, the first thing people think is that person legitimate? Do they have a right to be there? Can they hold my attention? Do I feel nervous? Can I forget myself and slip into their character? And for me, you know, when I see you perform, you just do that straight away. And it's an arresting and exciting thing to watch and experience. And I just wondered, how did you develop this? Because having all this anxiety about institutions and being able to move through them, and then just stepping in and owning that performance space, how did you do that?
Well, I did study acting in my 2 years of high school.
Okay.
my two years of high school. Actually, Berklee High School had at that time a pretty developed performing arts program, and the Bay Area has been a great place for, you know, for theater. So it's funny that I studied method. I read Stanislavski before I read Brecht.
Oh, the actor prepares.
And actually, I realized much later how just the how influential that was on my work, and not only perhaps on my capacity to perform, but also on other aspects of my work, the way of sort of thinking about your motivation, you know, and what one wants in a context, and also with a kind of appreciation for affect and for empathy that has not been part of, you know, the kind of critical, the traditions of critical art, which, you know, mostly come out of a Brechtian tradition of alienation and distanciation and a kind of rejection of empathy. But I think that my sort of training in, you know, minimal as it was, but my exposure to Stanislavski and to method acting, and also, you know, the psychological context in which I grew up, even if I wasn't aware of it, affect and empathy were always central to, you know, were always important. It's like, well, how do you connect with people, and how do you, but also a reflection on not only the sort of distancing, which I think can become so facile in a lot of critical practice and a lot of performance art in the art context, but also what is our connection to things? What is our investment in things? You know, because if we're just distancing and that's so easy, then what's the point of doing that? We have to get at what the connection is and what the investment is and what are the points of identification and what are the sort of intimate parts of ourselves that are at stake in our relationships with these institutions and these economies. And to me, that's where, you know, that's where one can influence the way that somebody thinks and someone feels. It's not just with intellectual arguments. Of course, I like intellectual arguments as well. But I think they need to be combined with a connectedness to those stakes and those investments.
Yeah, I can't think of another person who does combine that in the way that you do, from moving from really quite austere, carefully researched critical texts to like the highly effective performance, but also just me just talking to you, this is sort of freeness and an ease with having a conversation. That's something that's rare in the art world.
An artist.
Yeah, when you couple it with that idea of criticality, somehow criticality always is packaged as the thing that's kind of it has a kind of austere, bloodless severity about it, and not a kind of energy really. And it seems to me that everything that's executed by you has this sort of energy which is infectious. And that is able to galvanize someone to action. I think that is what's always missing sometimes from the more austere side of criticism, that you do need some empathy, you do need some affect in there. Otherwise, it's just, I don't know, it just passes over people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that's what's, you know, that's what's consciously and not more consciously, more recently, has really sort of been the sort of backbone, if you will, of my approach to art making and wanting to have an impact. And, you know, I think about critical art practice. For me, it's not whether I make a critique or not. You know, I mean, I can be as critical as I want to be, but if the work doesn't activate a kind of critical process in other people, then it's not critical as far as I'm concerned. But that critical process can't just be sort of distancing or denying, you know, it has to be a critical, it has to connect people to their own investments and their own kind of sense of stake in the moment. So that's my model. And to do that, I think you need both, you know, you need both the intellect and the emotional aspect. They have to be connected. To me, that's also part of the legacy of feminism. You know, I grew up in a feminist household, and the dictum of the personal and political, and the political is personal, you know, is sort of very much part of my thinking from an early age. One can't separate those two. And, you know, we can talk about financial economies, but those financial economies, you know, it's just money unless you connect it to affective economies. You know, what are the affective economies that lead us to invest in these financial economies that are so destructive, you know, and that are so that are so impoverishing of so many people. And so you have to look at both sides always.
I'd like to talk about your scripted performance pieces, and it's been a bit difficult for me to find one to choose from because there's so many kind of standout greatest hits basically in the work that you've done. So let me just ask about the piece Not Just a Few of Us, which I think you performed in 2014 at Prospect, the Biennial in New Orleans. Now, this is the last piece that I've seen you do like in the flesh.
Oh, you saw that live.
Yeah,
oh, that's
I was right. There.
You told me you saw that live. Yeah. You're one of the few people who actually saw me do that.
Yeah. And just to tell the audience, so basically the script for the piece came from a 1991 council meeting in New Orleans on the integration of historically segregated floats in Mardi Gras. And so you end up performing a one woman play in which you embody all of the different characters.
Well, they're people. I never call them characters. So, right, it was an epic marathon, I think 9 or 10 hour city council hearing about an ordinance that would require the integration of traditionally segregated carnival clubs and also private clubs. So the organizations that do the carnival parades in New Orleans, some of which went back from to before the Civil War and had been segregated for that long. So I transcribed and edited the 9 hours of hearing, and then I edited it down into about a 60-minute script that included 20 participants in the hearings, and half white, half black, mostly men, and each one of them with a completely different accent because it's New Orleans. You know? So that was the performance. That was a tough one.
Yeah, but it, again, that was that thing where immediately the presence was there. I didn't feel nervous. It wasn't like watching a kind of how can I explain it? Like I don't know, a display of gymnastics. Are you going to be able to do these flips that are kind of impossible? You know, like I just knew you were going to be able to do what you were doing, and I could just relax and listen and take in the performance.
See, I'm not sure that's such a good thing. I think you should be a little nervous, but maybe nervous about other things.
Well, I think more what was happening during the performance is I was thinking more about New Orleans as a place and mm-hmm. about segregation and about the sort of racial tension that was in the city, because we were in the city moving around, but also trying to make a documentary about the city at the time. And yeah, we were kind of encountering these weird things where you go in a museum, then cross the street and it would be like a Civil War memorial place, and you go in and it would be stuff that's basically glorifying a period where slavery was in full effect. And it felt to me that that discourse was kind of missing from the biennial, except when you were there, because I guess post Katrina it was more about just celebrating the fact that New Orleans is enduring and continuing and thriving. So there wasn't so much emphasis on like inter-community tensions, but they were there. And the only way I really felt them was through that piece. So it really changed my perception of the city, which I have relatives in anyway. But when I left, it was like, okay, I viewed it differently. So I suppose on one level, I'm talking about the comfort of watching the performance, but the content still unsettled me, which I think is really the most important thing.
Yeah, that was a very scary performance to do. You know, in America, and not only in America, because I was performing African Americans. Mm. And for a white person in America to take on and perform Black people, you know, I mean, there's a very bad, very bad history to that.
Yeah.
Of white performers performing in blackface and minstrelsy and so forth. But it was something that I felt, I don't know, you know, I can say I felt compelled to do. I don't know what that means, but the way that I conceptualize that performance, and it has a kind of a parallel to a performance that I did in 2012 called Men on the Line, Men Committed to Feminism, KPFK 1972, which was based on a live radio broadcast of four men basically having a consciousness raising group on radio live in 1972.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing.
Talking about feminism and their relationship to feminism, and there are four men, and I perform all four men having this conversation.
That sounds so amazing.
Oh yeah, there's a fairly long clip of it online. I can send you the link.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's now a video installation. But so in the context of that performance, it's when I really started to think a lot about empathy and about sort of the politics of empathy. And so here were these men trying to empathize and connect with feminism and with women and with women's experience. And so the challenge for me was, how do I connect to their, you know, how do I connect with their effort to connect? But it's also about thinking, it's a way of thinking about performance that, so one of the modes of performance that I've done since 1991, a performance called May I Help You, is what I call, you know, multi-voiced performances.
Right.
And I've done a few of them. May I Help You, Official Welcome, Inaugural Speech. Those were all written and they were constructed. And the idea was that I wanted to perform a field, you know? So May I Help You is like class relations. Mm. So I'm performing down a class hierarchy, you know, from a sort of high bourgeois connoisseurship to a sort of working class person who feels very alienated in a gallery. Is the idea of performing a social field or performing a field of an exhibition or something like that. And how do you perform these kinds of social relationships, you know, in time? And so with Men on the Line and Not Just a Few of Us, that thinking shifted a little bit. They're multi-voiced performances, and they're sort of performing groups, you know, performing a group of men or performing a community in a way. And part of my thinking about that is that, in fact, those groups, those other identities, those communities, you know, they also exist within individuals. So there's a kind of, could say, you know, well, in sort of Kleinian psychoanalysts talk about introjection and projection. Bourdieu talks about objectification and embodiment, of how sort of fantasies and ideas and attributes and ways of seeing and, you know, systems of classification and values and all of these sort of social and psychological things sort of pass from society and the group to the individual and sort of psychology, from the psychological to the social and the social to the psychological, from the group or the community to the individual and back again. And this movement, you know, inside and outside. And so that's how I think about performance a lot now, and how, you know, when I perform and I sort of, whether I'm constructing texts or editing them from transcripts, memorizing them, to me, I think about in terms of a process of internalization, a kind of very conscious process, a very kind of conscious version of what is happening all the time unconsciously, the way that we sort of take in other people and we take in society. Mm. And it becomes sort of part of ourselves in some ways, consciously or not, and turning that into a kind of conscious process. And how all of those social relationships, all of those racial race relations, the gender relations, you know, they exist inside of us and not only outside of us. So that's how we can kind of take them on. So not just a few of us. I mean, right, in one way, it's about integration. So using myself in a way, right, as a kind of site of integration, as a site of integrating these different voices and genders and races that were divided in the city and divided in this hearing and opposed to each other. There were very, very few white people testifying in support of the ordinance. And taking them into my body and kind of integrating them in myself. So that's how I was conceptualizing it.
You really embodied all of those different characters. And it made me feel like, as if there's just like a jumble of personalities within you during this intense period of like internalization. And again, it made me think about fear, because, you know, you were saying you're a bit worried about how the piece might be received in the US, but also that whenever you step up to the lectern or you step into the museum space, because the lectern is like that almost seems like your proscenium sometimes, you know, what does that feel like when you're just about to perform?
You know, yeah, performing is actually less scary to me than the scariest thing for me when I really, it's like, you know, I hope the plane crashes because I won't have to do this, is when I write papers that I have to read in public for the first time. That absolutely terrifies me. I don't know what it is, but there's something about, you know, reading in front of an audience and that I find absolutely mortifying. Somehow performing actually protects me. There's a kind of safety. There's a safety in that zone. There's a safety in having it memorized and in being able to sort of withdraw in some ways into that, you know, into those voices. I develop a connection with these voices. My husband, you know, describes them as my buddies, like the guys, the men on the line guys. they're my buddies. They're my friends. One of the most kind of extreme performances along those lines that I did was when I performed Martin Kippenberger and the German painter. And I found, you know, he was famous for doing these drunken dinner speeches. And I saw some of them, these sort of drunken speeches at his openings or after his openings or at dinners. And I memorized one of them in German, and I don't speak German. So 3,000 words of German, a 30-minute monologue in German. And that took me 6 weeks to memorize. And but when it was over, I kind of missed him, which was really so strange. He was like my invisible friend, you know? So, yeah, there's something, in a way, there's, you know, kind of psychologically, there's some kind of comfort that I take. There's something that I find enriching too, in that process of taking these voices inside my head. And I think that's part of the process for me, is that it's enriching, and hopefully it is for other people in some ways as well. ¶¶